Okay, pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote hearing of Human Services Finance and Policy to order. So the first item on our agenda is to take the roll call. So Ms. Hansen, can you please proceed?
Member Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Representative Albright. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Noor? Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Representative Albright, I rushed past you, I'm sorry. But I see you. Thank you, members.
Noor, present.
Thank you, Representative Noor. We have you. Okay, members, so we have to approve the minutes from February 2nd. So, Representative Novotny, would you like to move the minutes from February 2nd? He might not hear us. Representative Rasmussen, would you like?
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen moves approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2021. Any discussion? Make sure you're checking the minutes since we did take some roll call votes. Okay, hearing no discussion or corrections, please unmute yourself. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. The motion prevails and the minutes from February 2nd, 2021 are approved. Okay, today members, we have presentations from DHS. The first presentation, is about economic assistance programs. So we are going to be hearing bills on economic assistance. And I think also the commissioner will be touching on a report that they recently released on deep poverty. And this is a good homework assignment for you to hear about deep poverty. I believe it's defined as those who are under 50% or less of the federal poverty level. And that's about $21,000 a year for a family of three. And we're going to try to help address the deep poverty that families experience in Minnesota with several pieces of legislation. So it's an important report. You should all try to read, or at least the executive summary, and we'll send that out to members on the committee. The second presentation is about direct care and treatment. And so we're going to be learning more about direct care and treatment. We spend a significant amount of money in this area. It's important. The behavioral health system is already under a lot of stress and strain. So we'll learn about what they're experiencing, the shortages, and, you know, it's a very reliant on labor, so very expensive but important area to address. So we'll learn about that, and hopefully there'll be plenty of time for questions. So with that, members, I'm going to turn it over to our first presenter, Commissioner Harpstead. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Schultz. Thank you so much. Members, good morning. After the DHS commissioner introduces the four HHS committees of the House and Senate to the DHS portion of the governor's budget, it's customary to leave specific testimony on various proposals to assistant commissioners and others. I'm here today to speak personally to how the COVID pandemic gave me an unprecedented opportunity to learn about how the Minnesota Family Investment Program, otherwise known as MFIP, works and doesn't work in Minnesota. Of course, the most common reason a parent enrolled in MFIP is because they've lost a job. And the job categories that lead to MFIP enrollment are concentrated in the restaurant, hotel, retail, and healthcare industries, the ones we've all been reading about through 2020, which which goes a long way to explaining why the enrollment has grown by more than 5,000 families during the pandemic. While MFIT provides cash assistance and food support, the families are in deep poverty unless they combine that into a job that will get them a little above the poverty line. While it may have been true in former decades that when someone receiving assistance got a job, they transitioned off the MFIT benefit, in today's economy, people are working in jobs where their hours change every week, consistently changing their eligibility. Every time their income changes, their business changes. And to get there, they have to report and document each of those changes, creating an endless loop of paperwork for families to stay enrolled. So we accept people with volatile income and then make their public assistance volatile as well. And of course, this process also costs our county partners lots of paperwork that doesn't serve to stabilize families or support them in getting jobs and getting off the program. And that increases the probability of errors that we are systematically working to eliminate in all of our services. Federal SNAP food support, on the other hand, and Minnesota housing supports are granted to families for 6 months at a time without all the constant eligibility checks. Minnesota public health care benefits last for a year without constant recertification. The recently released DHS report, 2 years in the making, called Improving the Health of Minnesotans Living in Deep Poverty, was emailed to all committee members along with our testimony today. The first recommendation in the report is the proposed change to the MFIT program to give enrollees 6 months of uninterrupted benefits to allow them to spend their time filling out job applications instead of MFIT paperwork, something that they, and I would guess all Minnesotans, want to see. I'm here today to ask you to consider making this change to get Minnesotans off welfare and into paying jobs that allow them to support their families. The most compelling slide I saw this year was the following one that we'll wait for a moment to see posted. It shows our housing support benefits in Minnesota and how in 2016, we moved to a 6 month reporting process for our housing supports. And you can see how participants with countable earned income took off as we initiated 6 month reporting for a housing support benefit. This is the same sort of experience we might expect to see if we moved to a 6 month reporting requirement for MFIT. You can take the slide down, thank you. I advocated strongly with the governor and lieutenant governor to add this proposal to their January budget release and was thrilled when it was included, along with our proposal to give a one-time $750 payment to all families on MFIP, which would help families now who've been hit hardest by the pandemic before we have a chance to change how the benefit works long-term. Because our Minute colleagues would need time to reprogram our systems to accommodate the long-term change, it has a fairly minimal cost in the next biennium and a greater impact in details. Deborah Schlick, Economic Assistance and Employment Support's Strategic Projects Office, our authority on the dynamics of this service, will explain the proposal in more detail. Chair Schultz, if we could call on Deborah Schlick. Yes.
Good morning, Mrs. Schlick. Can you please introduce yourself for the record and maybe provide your title?
Yes. I'm Deborah Schlick. I work in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division of DHS, and I manage the Strategic Projects Office in that division. If they put the slides up, I can walk you through some information about the proposal that Commissioner Harfstedt has introduced. There are three roots to this proposal, and I want to talk about each of those just a little bit so you understand why the proposal, the specific proposals are what they are. The first is the department's report on the impact of deep poverty in medical assistance that Commissioner Harfstedt referenced. I'll give you a tiny bit of information about that. Secondly is what we know about the income volatility of the Minnesotans who turned to public assistance. And the third is a multi-year effort that the legislature launched a few years ago to simplify public assistance policy and create more uniform policies across the state's public assistance programs. So first, about the deep poverty issue. And Chair Schultz, you're right. That poverty line is just over $21,000 for a family of three. So if we're talking about deep poverty, we're talking about families living at $11,000 or less a year. That's about $900 of available income in any month. And what the Healthcare Administration of DHS found as it looked at social risk factors and health of people on medical assistance at the legislature's request, found that deep poverty correlates with very poor health outcomes. They found that adults in deep poverty have higher rates of every chronic condition that their study measured, including a mortality rate two times higher than adults who are not as poor. They found that adults in deep poverty experience 40% more preventable emergency room visits, and they end up at a rate of 23% more preventable hospitalizations than those who are not poor. And for children living in deep poverty, they also see a mortality rate two times higher than children at higher income levels, even children still in poverty, but not in deep poverty. And they experience a higher rate of post-traumatic stress syndrome than children who are not as poor. So these findings are really important documentation of the intersection of our work in economic assistance to provide income support and the department's work to provide healthcare coverage through medical assistance. So the one other root I spoke of is what we know about the volatility of the income of people who turn to us for assistance. As Commissioner Harpstead said, more than half the workers turning to public assistance come from one of four industries: hotel, restaurant, retail, low-wage healthcare, and temp agencies. And this is true not just for cash assistance, but these industries are heavily represented in the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that we used to call food stamps, and the Child Care Assistance Program. Next slide, please. And what we know about low-wage earners, whether or not they're using public assistance, is not only is their income low, but it's very unpredictable. So a national study done by Princeton a few years ago found that households of four making less than $40,000 a year experience much more income volatility than higher earning households. So it's that dual dilemma, not enough money and not a predictable source of money. Next slide, please. So we see this in our program. 44% of the families receiving assistance through the Minnesota Family Investment Program experience extreme income instability. And that's defined as having a 30% chance in any month to have zero income in that month or to have more than double their average monthly income. So there's a huge swings in income. Next slide, please. This is particularly true for workers. That dark blue bar you're seeing shows that 77% of households that we serve who have outside earnings have changes to their benefits in a three-month period. And those benefits change because their income changed. And that even households without outside earnings, households that are getting what we call unearned income, it might be child support payments, it might be help from the church in their community, it might be help from a community agency or a nonprofit, their benefits are changing. And that's because in both cases, whether it's earnings or it's unearned income, we adjust our benefits when the household's income changes. For people with unearned income, it's a dollar for dollar offset. So if the church says, we'll give you $200 to fix your car, then we're gonna reduce their benefits by $200. If it's earned income, we're not gonna do quite a dollar for dollar offset. We subtract some of the earnings as one of our incentives to work. But unfortunately, that reduction comes pretty quickly when the earnings start increasing. Next slide, please. And we see that more than half the households with earnings, so I have to do monthly reporting, I'll talk about that in a minute, had changes in income at least three times or more in a six-month period between January and 2017. So their income changed, then their benefits changed. So that cycle of back and forth is frequent. Next slide, please. So I've talked about two of the three roots, the deep poverty, what we've learned about deep poverty in health, what the income volatility of the people we serve, and then the complication of our policies. Public assistance rules are complicated. Every program has a set of complicated rules, as Commissioner Harkstead has learned, and they differ from program to program. So this leads to confusion between the program rules. It leads to errors at the front line in determining eligibility and benefits. It creates more demanding workloads for those frontline county and tribal eligibility workers. And it makes it much more difficult for workers to be able to handle multiple programs, even if the people we serve need help from multiple programs. Next slide, please. So to respond to that, the legislature in 2014 and then again in 2015 passed legislation that counties had backed and requested to create more uniform policies across the cash assistance programs. So among the progress made was that earned income disregard I talked about, deciding how much earned income not to count. The same formula was created across the programs. The same asset limit was set for programs, and we created a shared list of what actually counts as an asset. The legislature created more uniform reporting requirements and a more uniform list of what sources of income count against benefits. And whenever possible, those policy changes for the state's cash assistance program were designed to align with federal programs like Supplemental Security Income for the Disabled and Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, our food support program. So the proposal I'm going to describe to you, built out of those three roots, is focused on the state's cash assistance programs. It has its biggest impact in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which serves families with children in deep poverty. It also makes the same policy changes to general assistance, which serves adults without children. But fewer households are affected in the general assistance program, and I'll describe that later. And there are some tweaks to housing support. And that's the slide Commissioner Harkstead showed you. The housing support had 6-month reporting passed into legislation in 2015 and acted in 2016. So we're following their lead and their experience with this change. And the proposals we're making would align cash programs more closely with the federal SNAP policies. SNAP is the program we used to call food stamps. So the three changes being proposed are designed to deal with that problem of not only is the outside income that households receiving assistance receive volatile, but then our benefits become volatile. And much of that happens because of how we have our reporting policies set up. And our method for trying to reduce that volatility is to honor the mission of program simplification and uniformity. So there are three specific parts of this proposal I'm going to describe to you now. Instead of having households with earnings report every single month, we're going to put people on a 6-month reporting schedule. Secondly, we want to reduce the number of changes all households have to report to us in short order. And finally, we want to change the method we use to determine the benefit budget. So I'll walk through each of those, not in a lot of detail, but enough for you to understand what I'm talking about. So as the commissioner explained, and I've said, when someone gets a job while on assistance, even though we want to reward and support work, one of the ways we don't reward that work is we now require them to complete a 5-page form every month. And if there are errors in that form, if that form comes in too early or that form comes in too late, their benefits are delayed and the paperwork has to be fixed. And their benefits, even more importantly, become as volatile as their income. So instead, we want to set benefit amounts for 6 months at a time. We'd apply this policy to both MFIP and general assistance. As I said, housing support has already made this change. And this is current SNAP policy, where benefits are set for 6-month periods. This would apply in MFIP to all MFIP households. With or without earnings, every household would have a date on the calendar every 6 months where we look at their situation and see if we have to adjust their benefits. In general assistance, this would apply only to households who have earnings, which are about 3% of the caseload. General assistance households are primarily eligible because they have significant barriers to work. So it's a very different population besides not having children than the Minnesota Family Investment Program. So not only would we then say, okay, we've met with you, we're setting your benefits for 6 months, but we're also not going to ask people to report as many changes to us during that period. And we would take current law, which currently has 12 changes in circumstances that people have to report to us within 10 days, and we would reduce that to 7 changes. Though some programs would have some specific changes that are related to core eligibility. So I'd like to show you what we're talking about in specifics. Households in between those 6 month review periods we set would still have to tell us, have you changed your address or residence? Has someone joined or left your household? Have you gotten cash prizes or winnings? Are your assets at or over our asset limit? Is there a change in your citizenship or your immigration status? Is there a change in your family status? And this means the most common example would be two unmarried adults are living together. They marry. The new spouse now becomes a step parent. That changes their responsibility financially to the children. We need to know that. And then in addition, we want to know, has someone become eligible for a federal income support program, primarily disability income, SSI or RSDI? But we would no longer require across all programs, and that's the right-hand column, has there been a change in your earned income? Has there been a change in your unearned income? Has there been a change in your employment status or hours? Have you gotten a one-time payment, like that $200 to help repair your car from the church? We would stop asking those things because that's where we create volatility in our benefits, where we take the volatility of their income and then make our benefits as volatile. In addition, we don't need to know in all the programs, is there a new rent subsidy or a change in your rent subsidy? Have you sold, purchased, or transferred real estate? That almost never happens in our population, but we'd find it out at 6 months. And we don't have to know about the change in disability status. As I mentioned, each of the programs would have a couple of additional reporting requirements that are very essential to eligibility for that program. So in MFIP, for instance, a pregnant woman without any other children is eligible for MFIP. But if that pregnancy doesn't result in birth, she's not eligible. So we need to know that. We also need to know about school enrollment changes for teen parents or 18 or 19-year-olds in MFIP households who aren't parents. That's core to eligibility. In general assistance, they still want to know whether individuals served by general assistance are having changes in their unearned income. And they want to know if they've had a change in earned income of $100 or more, because then they'll be put, with that information, they can put them on a six-month reporting schedule. And they also need to know, because to be eligible for general assistance is not just a financial question, but it's about your circumstances. As I said, general assistance is for people unable to work. So if that changes, if they've recovered from an incapacitating illness, if a mental illness is in a period under control, if a residence in a facility has changed, that needs to be reported. And then housing support and Minnesota supplemental aid want to know if there's an unearned income change. And like GA, they want to know if there's an earned income change, because then housing support will put someone on a six-month reporting schedule. And I should have said Minnesota Supplemental Aid is a program that offers a small supplement to the federal SSI benefits that some Minnesotans receive. It's not touched by this proposal much because it's designed to align with those federal SSI policies. That makes the most sense for the people receiving the benefit and for the workers. Some housing support residents will also have to change I would have to report if there are changes in their shelter expenses or their rent subsidies, because housing support's helping pay the rent, and they want to know if their portion should go up or down. And the timing for these proposals. Right now, the state law says, tell us this within 10 days of it occurring. We want to propose that instead we line up with the same time frame that's set by federal SNAP policy. And that would be that you report the changes by the 10th of the month after the month in which the change occurred, which is complicated to hear, but if I'm on assistance and it's February and my spouse has left me and left the household, I need to let the worker, my county worker, know that by the 10th of March. By lining up with SNAP, we make it easier for both the workers and the participants to keep track of when they're supposed to report changes. For instance, 75% of the people receiving general assistance also receive SNAP. You can imagine how complicated it becomes if you have different deadlines for different programs. So I've talked about how we want to move workers off of monthly reporting, move people to a 6-month reporting schedule, how we want to ask people to report fewer changes to us so we can help make those benefits more predictable. And the third thing we want to do is change the formula we use for handling income. We want to use the most current income information we have, look at which of that income is likely to be anticipated to be received in the coming months, and use that to determine the benefit amount that someone will be getting. That is what the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program does. I want to show you why it's a change from what we do. What we do currently is we use income that's 2 months old. So again, assume I'm the person who's turned to assistance. It's February. I've gotten my paycheck for the month. I report that to the worker. In March, the worker uses that information to figure out my benefits for April. So my benefits in April are set based on income I had 2 months earlier. And as you've seen with the volatility, that's highly unlikely to be current information. From the research we've been able to do, we believe we're the only state that continues to use this method, which in the field is called retrospective budgeting. Every other state we could find that used to is now using the SNAP type policy of current income. So the impact of these changes, what do these proposals have to do with the root causes I described? For county and tribal workers, they're no longer going to have to process 10 to 13,000 5-page monthly report forms each month. And you have to understand, those report forms come in literally as pieces of paper. Workers type from those reports into Maxis. There's nothing automated. They're not like uploaded automatically into the system. Workers are also going to handle many fewer reports of changes to process each month. And one way to illustrate work that I've never done, and many of you probably aren't familiar with that frontline eligibility worker work, but one way to quantify it is that right now the manual we offer for eligibility workers has 14 pages of instructions in how to handle reporting requirements. We'll be able to cut those by at least half. So the impact of the changes we're proposing on the people who turn to cash assistance in crisis is to create, very importantly, one element of predictability in their budget. And this is key, as one community member whose organization participated in a work group with us to develop these proposals a couple of years ago said, these 6-month periods become periods in which people can build up momentum to achieve, make economic stability more possible. They can get ahead instead of continue to, as they get some help here, watch our help decline. They can get enough help to get some stability. And finally, the impact on the state. Commissioner Harpstead said, the benefits we offer are at a deep poverty level or just barely above deep poverty. But this leverages that public investment with the household's earnings and with private help from churches, from nonprofits, from community organizations, and coupled, those the public and the private assistance can help more households move beyond deep poverty, beyond poverty, and even to economic stability. This would be effective May 1st, 2023. As Commissioner Harpstead said, this will require some significant reprogramming of the eligibility IT system frontline workers use, called MAXIS. And when effective, it would be phased in over 12 months. As families are having their annual redetermination of eligibility, or if they submit a monthly household report form, they'd be moved to this new six-month reporting and reduced reporting schedule. I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick, for this presentation. I'll take a few questions, and then we have one testifier, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that the department is trying to drag us into the 21st century. It's really great. A lot of this is just so long overdue. But one concern that, well, a couple of things. One is the last slide about how long it's going to take to do this. And I just wonder, gosh, isn't there any way we could speed it up? That would be one question. But the other one would be that I just want to make sure that we're not setting up any families to fail. And the one thing that concerns me a bit is that there still are a lot of things that they do have to report if they should happen within the 6 months. And to make sure that the families, you know that and are on top of it so that they don't, you know, those things don't not happen just because of people aren't thinking about reporting and so on. And that we, you know, make sure that we aren't setting people up to fail in that respect. So how is that going to work?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Liebling, take the first question first. The time it's going to take is because we're really going to the heart of the programming of the IT system. We're asking them to change everything that's hardwired into that system about how to treat income and how to calculate it to get a benefit. And we would have been happy to see that be a faster process, but we also know from experience that when we push the IT system to unreasonable deadlines, we have unhappy results. Secondly, we are concerned, there's been about those items people have to change, which is a current reality too. We think this proposal will help some of that dilemma of how do you, in a very busy life that is still pretty dominated by crisis, remember all our program requirements. And so it can help that, first of all, that they're the same across the programs, that when I'm on SNAP and I know what I have to report, and then if I'm on MFIP, it isn't new rules. And that a shorter list is easier to remember than a longer list. But in addition, we'd like to use that time as the programming is done to work with our local partners about what are some good communication ways we can help people keep track of what we ask of them.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Liebling? Okay, Representative Bonner.
First of all, thank you, Commissioner Harpstead and Ms. Schlick for this presentation. You should know in my real life, I do a lot of work around streamlining systems, modernizing them, making them more accessible and usable. So I commend those efforts and certainly making sure that we have systems that work for actual citizens is really helpful. And of course, for our teens. I guess the question I have, and this certainly can go offline and we could talk about this offline if it's not, we may not have sufficient time here, but I would like to know a little bit more about the work that has been going on with Minute and if they've been looking at possibly a more phased in approach to some of these changes. I know in a more agile development cycle, often we can do that in a more phased approach so that we could slowly ease into those things, but it may ease some of that burden sooner. And I'm more curious about how that looks. And again, this might be an offline discussion with Minute and you, but certainly would love to hear more about that.
Ms. Schlick?
Commissioner Schultz and Representative Bonner. Yes. In fact, the first timeline we got on implementation was longer than this, and Commissioner Harpstead pushed back and said, does it have to be that long? So Minnit was able to propose a more phased-in approach, and I'd be happy as to get that information to you about which pieces they're going to do first and what they think they can hold till the end.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Bonner. And I am hoping to have an overview of our legacy IT systems that the counties use for many of these programs. But to me, this sounds like a great idea to remove a lot of the barriers from families that are already experiencing a lot of crisis and trauma in their lives, make it more consistent, and hopefully if they're eligible for more than one of our programs, to simplify the reporting even more down the road where they're only reporting once for all of the programs they're eligible for. Representative Sandel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks very much, Ms. Schlick and Commissioner. The information presented was really interesting and easy to follow. Applications for each one of these programs really seems to be imposing, particularly when I'd expect documentation to be submitted or required with each application. What kind of documentation do families have to submit each time they're required to re-up for a program?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Sandel. So when families apply for assistance and they have to prove relationship. So we need birth certificates and marriage certificates. They have to prove income. So they have to submit paychecks or other documents of income. They have to prove assets. So we need to see records of bank accounts and whether they're cars and their values. If there's a non-custodial parent, they have to show to the child support system all the efforts they're making to help child support enforce that. Those are some of the highlights. I'm sure I'm missing some of them, but it is a significant set of records we ask for.
Maybe it might be helpful for members to get an application emailed to them so they can see what's required for that program and what documentation is required. That's a great question, Representative Sandel. Do you have a follow-up?
Just quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. This may be a very naive question, but would it be possible for a single application or a single application form that the family would have to submit and it could be reviewed for each one of these programs the department could identify what assistance a family is eligible for? It might be a very naive question, so.
No, not naive at all. Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Sandel. In fact, we use what's called a combined application form. It makes it a longer, I see Representative Noor nodding, he's familiar with it. It makes it a longer form, but it is designed to be, you can fill in this information once, supply your documentation, we can decide, are you eligible for cash assistance? Are you eligible for SNAP? It used to also cover healthcare, but once healthcare was changed so dramatically and put on a different system, that's changed some. But there is a combined application form, so not at all a naive question.
Thank you. Representative Sandel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Schlick and Commissioner. Thank you.
Representative Noor?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Commissioner Hofstede and Ms. Schlick. I think this is something that we should all be celebrating. I remember when I was a financial worker at the county, I had more than 300 cases, and the day that I always think that I'm going to go crazy is we have to process household report forms before the 16th of the month. And the requirement is for everybody to submit their forms with the income verification, changes in their household, so many changes that may happen in a human life. You have to take that into account. And then when you use that as a retrospective income, and you haven't even received your paycheck, you know, sometimes there could be delays with the employers and so many other things, it gets really, really complicated. I think sometimes we may look at the program from one perspective, but I do appreciate that we're moving from retrospective budgeting to prospective budgeting. I understand the challenges ahead, you know, not only working as a financial worker, but also being in systems management at DHS, seeing through those changes that we implement. This is a system more than 30 years old that we're trying to make changes immediately. And there's so many things that we have to take into account if we are really serious about making a significant investment. I think we need to look into the modernization of our IT systems so that we can be able even to take those changes directly from the participants, the recipients of this program, including submitting the applications online. Today, in a world whereby we have an app for everything, I think we can simplify the lives for individuals. Just wanted to ask a quick question about the work participation rates that we will be collecting that data and how that also interacts with this simplification, including the work that is done by the employment service providers as they meet with the participants who are in the workforce.
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Noor. So the work participation rate, for committee members who aren't as familiar with it, that's the federal process measure that we're held accountable to in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. We're asked to count how many parents are in one of 12 activities for a minimum number of hours every month. I always point out we're not asked to record how many people get jobs that take them off assistance. It is not an outcome measure, it's a process measure. So participant, well, of course, one of the counted work activities is to be employed. And so we report to the federal government what we see in MAXIS about how many employment hours people have. This will change how we do our reporting for that, because we won't be getting the information every month. But the federal law used by most states, but not Minnesota, because of our process, allows states to take the first paycheck that's reported and assume that's unchanged information for a six-month period. But part of our work in the implementation will be making sure that all our reporting, the way we do our reporting is changed and meets the federal standards.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Noor?
Thank you so much. I just also wanted to remind members that the same participant is also working with the childcare worker. They're also working with the employment service provider, which they're also required to provide some of the same data. So we want to be more consistent and to be able to have a platform whereby you report it once. You don't have to go back into reporting to each and every entity separately and to every worker separately. So thank you so much, Ms. Schlick and Commissioner Hampton.
Thank you, Representative Noor. We're really grateful to have your expertise on this committee along with the expertise of Representative Bonner as we dive into all of these complex issues. We're running out of time, so Representative Albright, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And 2 points for Ms. Schlick. First is an observation just from a standpoint of my background in economics, but I'm wondering if you have ever considered, for the benefit of participants who might realize a job or an increase in income for a couple of months, but then that job is terminated and no longer available to them. I'm wondering if you've ever considered something akin to an income smoothing perspective that would candidly assess the same type of income, but over a number of months, not availing them to be dropped off, but also as an outcome of moving them off of MFIP or some of these programs, it would actually provide for a smoother transition and not penalize them for an increase in wages, if you understand what. And I do have just one follow-up, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright. I think we'd be interested in hearing some more specifics of that. So I do think that we see this proposal as, we hadn't used that term income smoothing, but that that would be designed to do that, your benefits are not going to go down immediately when your earned income goes up, that we create a period of time. And if your income goes down, people can let us know that. I should have said that. In the 6-month reporting period, people are still can contact us and tell us, hey, my income went up. You might want to know that. I want to be off assistance. Or they can also tell us it's gone down. I need you to adjust because, you know, I lost that job. But I think we'd be interested in a follow-up conversation very much.
Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, and Ms. Schlick, I look forward to that. I think that's, you know, we oftentimes are frustrated by the cliff that people observe when they do find success in terms of finding employment. And that would help to kind of persuade people to take a little longer term perspective in terms of income. But to the income perspective alone, we've had a number of individuals, particularly those unemployed that have received unemployment benefits over the course of this last several months. And it's my understanding that you only need to report at application and recertification. So from a program integrity perspective, if you are receiving, let's say, $30,000 in a year's time for unemployment benefits, but that isn't being reported, that would be very concerned from the integrity of the perspective of the program when you are realizing an incredible increase in your benefits, but not having the responsibility to report it. That, to me, how would you get that? And I'm careful of using this phrase, but how would you go about countering and catching that fraud if they're not having to report it currently?
Ms. Schlick?
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright, we do count unemployment insurance benefits against the cash assistance benefit. And right now, people do have to report. So during COVID, when there were those significant supplements to unemployment insurance, we asked people to report. Workers were asked to confirm that with UI. And we saw, we have seen a correlation in our data. When those benefits went into effect, our caseloads dropped. When the benefits ended, our caseloads increased. And even when we had staff then do some, pull some sample cases to see what was going on, the sample cases all related to unemployment insurance. So we might not catch in a 6-month reporting situation that someone's on unemployment insurance the first month they're on, but we would see it within a couple months and then adjust their benefits. And depending on what unemployment insurance benefits are at that point, they might be ineligible. Without the COVID supplements, these low-wage workers are not getting much in unemployment insurance because it's only a portion of wages earned. But that's a very important question and point to raise.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick, and thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Keel.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we should, as Representative Albright pointed out, I think we should be looking at that detail. I can think of some seasonal work that creates some real issues with reporting and, you know, it's a heavily spot job up here in the Northwest, usually lasts 2 to 3 weeks. But more concern I have is the internet question, the minute question, having lived, and I know quite a few members have lived the transportation issues with online changes. I think we got to be super careful about putting that out and having some real challenges. So I'm wondering how we're addressing that part of the concern. If that's what we're looking at is changing that whole system, because I think this is as complicated, if not more complicated, than transportation, DHS would be.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Keel. So to one clarification and then an answer, none of this, the way the eligibility IT system Maxis works is it's not an internet-based system. It's a system the worker enters data into, but participants don't upload information to it the way we might send information to our bank. But I think your point is well taken that we want the changes to be done thoughtfully, and we want enough time for quality assurance testing, and that's what pushes the implementation date out on this, is what I've learned in my work at DHS with our colleagues at Minute is it's particularly that quality assurance testing time that adds the most time, but they've convinced us why it's so important to do.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Representative Keel. Thank you. I would also caution that in transportation, they tested it and assured us, I sat in the committee more than once, that this was all ready to go and would work well and was absolutely a nightmare for many things. And I realized that, you know, it's a little different at who's putting the information in. But I just have some real concerns about what we're doing. And not to mention the cost exploded to get this fixed once it went that direction. So I think we got to be really careful. I'm really concerned about the cost we're talking about here.
Thank you, Representative Keel. I'm hoping the cost will go down in terms of administering this program because we're reducing a lot of the paperwork that counties are doing. So they should see reduction in their workload and a reduction in administrative expenses over time. But Ms. Schlick, do you want to respond to that?
Representative Schultz and Representative Keel, I think two things. One, we're Representative Neuer pointed out this is a 30-year-old system. That comes with its own headaches, but at least it's not a brand new system. It's a known quantity. And so the changes are not as dramatic as setting up a brand new system. And recently, in our work with Minute, one of the practices that was introduced is asking county frontline eligibility workers to be part of the quality assurance testing. Everyone involved thought that added significant value to the process.
Thank you, Representative Keel and Ms. Schlick. We need to move on to the testifier, and then Representative Albright will come back to you if we have time, because we have one more presentation on direct care and treatment.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to reiterate with Ms. Schlick, if she could send me authentication on the point about the unemployment benefits being tracked for certification. My understanding is that what she said, and I do not dispute what she's saying, but I just like to verify, because in my own mind, from my experience, there's a disconnect between what I know and what she is saying. So if she could just verify that statement and just send it to me offline, that's all I had.
Okay, she's nodding her head, so she will send you more information on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Question. Okay, we have one testifier, Bharti Wahi. Bharti Wahi is the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund. So please introduce yourself to the committee and welcome.
Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Bharti Wahi and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund. CDF, our mission is to ensure that all children have the best possible start in life with a caring community around them. We appreciate the opportunity to share our support for the governor's proposals to provide a $750 emergency payment for families accessing MFIP, and for the economic assistance program uniformity elements that Ms. Schlick has mentioned. More than anything else, I'm here to highlight for the committee that at its core, the Minnesota Family Investment Program is a children's program. The vast majority of Minnesotans who benefit from the program each year are children. 7 in 10 recipients of MFIP, or 59,000 children across the state of Minnesota. Almost half of them are under the age of 6. as has been highlighted by the commissioner around regarding the deep poverty report that was conducted, half the children and caregivers enrolled in MFIP are in households that have incomes that keep them in deep poverty. The economic and health impacts of COVID-19 have not fallen evenly across our populations, and households with children, particularly children in low-income households, are facing disproportionate share of the negative effects of the pandemic and the economic crisis. Based on a robust and a growing body of research, the National Academy of Sciences finds that even small increases in family income, especially during early childhood, can have a significant impact on the trajectory of a child's life, improving academic, health, and economic outcomes. We also know that family income stability and a reduction in the volatility, as was mentioned earlier, also has positive impacts. Minnesota has done an amazing job of addressing the challenges and needs during COVID-19 and using federal resources that have come to it to good effect. And given the number of children who would be impacted, we are excited to see the governor's proposal. We know that the $750 emergency support that would use federal funds would be a vital support to children during this challenging time, and that money flows back into community as families are spending those resources on their needs. We also believe that COVID has given us an opportunity to improve efficiency and effectiveness of government, benefiting families and agencies. CDF has partnered for years with state agencies and legislators on the win-win shared mission. For this reason, we're excited to see the governor's proposal to simplify income support program administration and aligning reporting requirements with other programs. This would allow greater stability and help propel families forward. The cliff was mentioned, and I think that some of these measures are really important to start addressing how families can propel and launch towards greater economic security. At the end of the day, 59,000 Minnesota children who are most under-resourced and overburdened need this support. We believe these proposals, if adopted, could improve the economic and home stability for thousands of children served each year. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Wahi, and thank you for testifying, but more importantly, thank you for all the important work you're doing in Minnesota on behalf of children and families. Really appreciate it. And members, a letter from the Children's Defense Fund was in your packet. It's also posted on our committee website. Okay, next up, we have a presentation on direct care and treatment by Commissioner Harpstead. So you want to tee up your slides if you have them and introduce yourself one more time for the committee.
Thank you. Dodie Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Here today to talk to you about our direct care and treatment program across Minnesota. Our direct care and treatment services are a highly specialized, generally behavioral healthcare system. You can think of our DCT system as about the same size as the CentraCare health system in central Minnesota. We have impact in serving more than 12,000 civilly committed patients, clients, individuals served every year in different levels of services at more than 200 sites statewide, delivered by about 5,000 employees. Our total operating budget was about $550 million last year. We have several divisions in our direct care and treatment services, our mental health and substance abuse treatment services, forensic services, our community-based services, which you can think of as primarily four-person group homes for people with disabilities, our ambulatory services, and which we're about, and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Our mental health and substance use treatment services include the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which you've heard much about over the years, our six community behavioral health hospitals, our brand new child and adolescent behavioral health hospital in Wilmer, our system of community addiction and recovery enterprise services, and Minnesota specialty health systems, primarily our intensive residential services for people with mental illness. A combined budget of $155 million. Our forensic services include the Forensic Mental Health Program and Nursing Home in St. Peter, Minnesota, with about $121 million budget. Our community-based services include residential services for people with developmental disabilities, vocational services for them as well, community support services, our intensive therapeutics homes, and the Minnesota LifeBridge service for $126 million annual operating budget. We have a handful of ambulatory services, especially our specialty care dental clinics. We have 5 clinics across Minnesota. We're very proud of the clinic we just opened in collaboration with Appletree Dental in Fergus Falls, the total dental clinic budget at $5 million a year. And then the Minnesota Sex Offender Program includes our facility in Moose Lake, one in St. Peter, community preparation services, and reintegration services for a combined total of $98.8 million. Our operations of direct care and treatment include financial management, facility management, medical services, admissions, technology support, and health information management, quality and compliance in the Office of Special Investigation. I would like to point out, as I did once before to the committee in the fall, that this is not your typical operations group. It's not the lawyers and accountants of the system. These are the clinicians who run the system and run all of the medical services across the system, and the clinicians who got the system through the COVID pandemic. We are currently COVID-free across the entire direct care and treatment system, both employees and the people we support. Our operations have a $42.7 million annual budget. I want to go back to a little bit of history. Some of you will remember this. In 2015, we had budget challenges, and we had across-the-board cuts in DCT, which left us with inadequate clinical staffing, increased staff injuries, and an overuse of seclusion and restraints. In 2016, at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, their CMS certification was at stake, and there were violent outbreaks at the St. Peter Hospital. In 2016, our CEO, Marshall Smith, was hired to lead DCT and to bring his Lean Six Sigma quality control process to the system. By 2020, you had no headlines from our direct care and treatment services. And in July, we were all COVID-free across the system, patients, clients, and individuals. We did have a surge in cases in the fall, and we're back to COVID-free this week. As we look forward, Marshall Smith's biggest possibility for DCT is that DCT will achieve the readiness criteria to be an eligible candidate for the National Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award. If we actually received that quality award, we would be the first Department of State government ever to receive it. We're grateful for the investments that the legislature has made over the years. Since 2015, we've had increased capacity for complex needs at the Anoka Treatment Center, funding for weekend coverage and clinical oversight at Anoka, funding to eliminate conditional licensing at forensics and increase funding for staff there, funding to increase mental health residential treatment capacity, to increase capacity in our community behavioral health hospitals, and funding for MSOP community preparation services. Actions taken to address the shortfall we had in 21 include eliminating open positions in forensic services that were no longer needed, accelerating the transition of group homes to community providers, an effort that the legislature asked us to develop over the last several years, discontinuing the sex offender treatment program that's inside the Moose Lake Correctional Facility, closing one residential mental health program in St. Paul. We also are contributing to long-term savings that didn't count toward our 21 budget by surplusing the entire Cambridge campus, which is no longer used by our programs, except for our dental program. They're looking for another office offsite of the campus. And so that entire large piece of property in Cambridge would be eligible for sale, and the savings of that would go into the general fund. We are also looking at one-time actions to preserve programs and jobs in Greater Minnesota by reducing administrative costs, requiring additional justifications for hiring, cutting recruitment and retention budgets, using salary savings leave, et cetera. In the fall of 2020, the legislature passed a $16 million investment to support our operations and to bring us to being on budget for fiscal 21. And also provided some capital investments for asset preservation and to improve our facilities in the sex offender program in St. Peter and the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital in Willmar. This is the pie chart of projected costs for fiscal year 2022. You can see from the right side of the pie chart that our forensic services, our sex offender program, and the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, services that really can only be operated by the state, comprise about 50% of our budget. Our state-operated group homes, another 20% of the budget. Those community behavioral health hospitals, 9%. And then there's several very small wedges of services that can also be provided by private providers in the community. And then our central operations and other services leave us with only a 15% overall overhead across the system, which is very good for a health system of this size. And so in the budget, governor's budget, this session is a $68 million projected deficit for fiscal years 22 and 23. The causes are steadily rising compensation costs, including negotiated salary and benefit increases, reimbursement rates that don't meet the cost of residential and vocational services for a substantial number of clients with disabilities. Without an operating adjustment, our options are very limited. We looked at all the options we could imagine in the fall to bring in the fiscal 21 budget, and we took a lot of those savings then. And across the board budget reductions, which would impact both capacity and staffing, are a concern. And reducing capacity or staffing in core programs would impact the availability of critical services and could jeopardize patient and staff safety. We would hate to go back to the history we had in the last 5 or 6 years. Administrative reductions. DCT is unable to simply reduce administrative and support budgets for management to close the gap. These staff are critical to maintaining effective operations and overseeing programs and assuring compliance issues don't arise. And as I said, we wouldn't want to go back and repeat some of the past issues and run into problems again with those things. Also across the board, reductions ultimately undermine the integrity, therapeutic effectiveness, and safety of the system. Historically, when faced with budget constraints, DCT reduced costs across the board, resulting in negative issues, poor quality, safety, and compliance. This impacted the ability to recruit and retain competent staff. With the work that's been done to improve the quality, safety, and patient outcomes, this is not an environment we want to return to. Decreasing capacity or staffing in core programs reduces the availability of critical services like at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center or community behavioral health hospitals that counties rely on to be able to have patients and clients go to for a period of time before finding other step-down sorts of services in their own areas. Patients would experience substantial delays in admission and be stuck in community hospitals or jails awaiting treatment. DCT would risk being out of compliance with the priority admission statute, also known as the 48-hour rule. Further compliance issues could jeopardize accreditation and DCT's availability to bill for services, and counties who rely on DCT for placement of behaviorally challenged patients would be impacted by any reduction in our capacity. That is our presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead. I have one question and then members may have additional questions. Do we put any money at risk, federal funds at risk, if we reduce our staff or our operations?
Matt, do we have someone here to answer the budget questions?
Mr. Burdick?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we have Dave Greenman on the line who can help with that.
Our budget director.
Hi, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, no, we don't put federal money at risk at this point.
And do you know offhand the federal dollars that flow to Minnesota for direct care and treatment?
I believe there's very little federal money going into this program, is my understanding. It's almost completely funded through the general fund and also enterprise dollars that DCT receives. In fact, I'm being told now that there's no federal money coming into fund DCT.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, Medicaid Dr. match, right? Medicaid match.
Yes, MA is the, excuse me, Representative Liebling, Commissioner Schultz, or I mean, Chair Schultz. There is a Medicaid match, yes. But it doesn't go directly to DCT.
Okay, thank you, Director Greenman. Let me see who we have on the list. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. And a question for Commissioner Harpstad. You know, I was looking at your last slide where you're talking about, you know, you want to make sure we don't have decreased capacity for Anoka Regional Treatment Center, the community behavioral hospitals. The question I have is kind of in the opposite direction. That is, how often are they operating at capacity? Because I keep on hearing stories about people who are in emergency rooms who are waiting and they can't get in to either of these facilities. And so how often are you beyond capacity? What is your average capacity out there? And do you have any idea of how many times you've turned people away that needed the services and had to wait?
Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Fisher. We could get you that statistic over the several years. I've been most closely following DCT through COVID. And while we came very close to the edge of having to close admissions to some of these services, and we've had some census caps to get through COVID, for the most part, we were able to keep things moving. But we can find out in a non-COVID time what the answer to your question is and get you that data.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Thank you, Commissioner Harpstad. It would be good to know as we're dealing with other issues in the behavioral health system, trying to figure out, you know, where the backups are and how do we better address those. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming and speaking to us today. The Community and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital in Willmar, is that the only one of its kind? And then the second question that I would have is that a new iteration of the CBHHs that were around and significantly closed or completely closed a few years ago?
Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative, you're getting out before my time. I wonder if Matt Burdick could answer that question.
Mr. Burdick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick, Director of State Government Relations with Department of Human Services. This program is unique in our system. It's our only children and adolescent-focused hospital. And while there are other inpatient psychiatric units for children and adolescents, as the commissioner mentioned, we try to focus on serving those who can't be served effectively by other providers. And so this is a new safety net level service that we've created in recent years and was recently redeveloped from an old facility that had some challenges. And so this is a brand new facility trying to meet the need, the very pressing need we know that exists in the community for adolescent inpatient psychiatric services.
Thank you, Mr. Burdick. Representative Frederick?
Okay, so just to clarify, it's the only one that we have, and it's a differentiation between the CBHHs that were around in the past is that this is also then including services targeted at adolescents.
Mr. Burdick?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Frederick. Yes, this is the only state-operated program that we have that is inpatient hospital level of care for adolescents, and that is the distinguishing factor between our other community hospitals, which focus on adults. As I mentioned, other community providers do offer some inpatient mental health services, but this is our only state-run program that focuses on youth and adolescents at that level.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other thing I do want to point out, too, is on the slide that talked about in 2015 about some of the assaults that were going on in the forensics program, I don't want anyone to walk away thinking that there aren't still assaults that are happening. I've been in conversations with staff that assaults are still ongoing, and so it is still an issue that we need to make sure that we are addressing the safety concerns of the patients, but also the staff that work there. And I look forward to having more conversations on that topic.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Frederick. We appreciate your talents on this committee as well and your experience. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank the commissioner and her team for the collaborative approach that they took with the new Center for Dental Health in Fergus Falls. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to send out an article to the committee members that actually describes DHS's partnership with nonprofits, local business leaders, and also the city of Fergus Falls, which issued bonds. The community of Fergus Falls really appreciates the collaborative approach and the surrounding area does too. So thank you, Commissioner, for the work.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. I don't know if the commissioner would like to comment on that.
Well, we're just so very proud of that new dental clinic in collaboration with Appletree Dental. We both had clinics in the Fergus Falls area, and it was time for both of us to look at new facilities. The genius of the program, I believe, is that we have different entrances for the different people using the different services, but we're sharing some of the expensive x-ray and other medical equipment in the center of the building. It's a beautiful way to share the most expensive elements of a dental clinic while having some separate waiting rooms and patient facilities. So very excited about it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Rasmussen, did you have any follow-up? That is fine by me to send that information out. We look forward to getting that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nothing further. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if this question is for the Commissioner or Mr. Burdick. But with regard to the $68 million deficit, I'm wondering what the partition of that amount is between personnel costs and building maintenance and non-personnel food, medical supplies. If there's a breakdown, I think it would be beneficial for the committee to know that.
Commissioner or Mr. Burdick?
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman from DHS. Maybe
Director Greenman?
Try to answer that. I think the breakdown is about 80% personnel and about 20% other costs, and that could include other things related to things like you were mentioning, Representative Albright, building maintenance, other costs associated with operating the DCT programs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Greenman. Anticipating that we will be in a new round of collective bargaining negotiations going forward with the folks within DCT. I'm wondering if that deficit is anticipatory of any presumed agreement on a new contract, or is that just existent contracts for personal costs?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the current deficit is based on the current contracts. These are based on costs that have already been incurred or that we already plan on having incurred under the current contract.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Greenman, again, when does that current collective bargaining agreement, when is the end date for that? And when do I anticipate that, or you would anticipate that new negotiations will commence on the new contract?
Director Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I don't have that information with me at this time, but we can get that for you.
Thank you, Director Greenman. Representative Albright?
Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions from members. We appreciate your time, Commissioner, and Mr. Burdick and Director Greenman. So thank you for this presentation.
Thank you.
Members, I have a few announcements. The first announcement is that Ms. Sunderman, our nonpartisan research staff, followed up with questions we had from yesterday about reporting, grant reporting. So when community organizations or individuals receive grants, the reports that are required, but not necessarily need to be written in the legislation brought forward. So I'm going to follow up via email with some more information for members about those reporting requirements. And second, we have three bills on the agenda for tomorrow. They are around emergency shelter appropriations and housing support. I think all three of those bills are in Chair Gomez's committee today, and hopefully will get referred to us tomorrow. So check your email and read through those bills that will be before us tomorrow. And then third, Representative Albright had recommended a book, Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. I've read the book. Representative Albright's recommending it to the members, and we're applying for funds to purchase the book for members. So if you have the book, or if you need the book, would like us to purchase it for you, if we get approval, please send Ms. Hansen an email asking for a copy of the book. Otherwise, you can always check it out from your local library, or I may have a copy and can bring it to the SOB to lend to other members as well. So if you want a copy of the book, and if we get approval, please send an email to Ms. Hansen so we can start a list. And those are all the announcements I have today. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we will see everyone tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.